From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Chief Chris Kyle?
Yes, sir.
We met in Fallujah. You saved my life.
Today, Bradley Cooper talks about playing Navy SEAL sniper Chris Kyle in the new film American Sniper. The film has become a cultural lightning rod, sparking arguments about its portrayal of the war in Iraq.
You know, the fact that it's inciting a discussion that has nothing to do with vets and it's more about the Iraq war. Every conversation that is in those terms, Terry, is moving farther and farther away from what our soldiers go through.
Also, a neuroscientist explains the brain circuitry responsible for the sense of touch and the experience of pleasure and pain. And as TV critic, I'll review the new Breaking Bad spinoff, Better Call Saul.
Yeah, I just think I'd look guilty if I hired a lawyer.
Actually, it's getting arrested that makes people look guilty, even the innocent ones. And innocent people get arrested every day.
That's coming up on Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Bradley Cooper, stars in the film American Sniper, which has become a cultural lightning rod with people from the left and right arguing with each other about the film and its depiction of the war in Iraq. We're going to hear Cooper's reaction, but mostly talk about how and why he made this film. He's nominated for an Oscar for his performance. The film is nominated for 5 other Oscars, including Best Picture. Cooper plays Chris Kyle, who is considered the most skilled sniper in U.S. military history and was nicknamed the Legend. He was a Navy SEAL who, after surviving 4 tours in Iraq, killing an estimated 160 people, was murdered near his home by a troubled vet he was trying to help. In Iraq, Kyle was usually on overwatch, stationed on a rooftop, preventing insurgents from ambushing Marines. But in this scene, he tells a fellow SEAL he wants to be on the ground searching door-to-door with the Marines.
I'll tell you something, these Marines keep rushing in like they're doing. They're going to have their asses shot off.
Oh, the Marines. They don't get the training we do. Half these guys were civilians 6 months ago.
Well, let's coach him up. I'll show them how team guys do it. I'll leave the unit on the street.
No, we can't do that. We need you on overwatch.
Come on, if I'm on the street, Mark,
look, I can... House to house is the deadliest job here, man. You got some sort of savior complex?
I just want to get the bad guys, but if I can't see them, I can't shoot them.
Look, all these guys, they know your name. They feel invincible with you up there.
They're not.
They are if they think they are. Why don't you just keep banging on the long gun? We'll let these dogs sniff out Zarqawi.
American Sniper alternates between scenes of Kyle in Iraq and at home between deployments. At home, he becomes emotionally detached and unable to acknowledge what others realize, that the war is taking a terrible toll on him. In this scene, he's back home in Texas at an auto repair shop, where he's recognized by a vet who approaches him. In the course of the conversation, the vet lifts one pant leg to reveal the prosthetic that's replaced the leg he lost.
Chief Chris Kyle?
Yes, sir.
My name is Mads. We met in Fallujah. You saved my life.
They just need to balance.
I did?
Yes, sir. We were stuck in a house until you came in with first Marines. You were the one that carried me out.
Oh, wow. Well, the Marines saved our ass plenty of times. How are you? You all right? You holding up?
Great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just grateful to be alive. It hasn't been...
Cool.
It hasn't been easy. But, you know... A lot of guys lost more than just a leg.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You lose some friends?
Well, that too, but I'm talking about the guys that lived. You know, they made it back, but they're just not back, you know? They can't seem to get right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you come down to the VA sometime? The guys would love it. They all know who the Legend is. My family thanks you for your service.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Bradley Cooper is currently starring in the Broadway revival of The Elephant Man. Terry spoke with Cooper last week.
Bradley Cooper, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm so happy to have the chance to talk with you again. I gotta ask you, were you expecting your film to become this cultural lightning rod?
Absolutely not. First of all, it's so great to be here, Terry. Thanks for having me. No, I did not at all. I don't think one could ever foresee something like that happening.
Let me ask you about just like a couple of points that critics of the film from the left are pointing out. People say that you don't point out in the film that Iraq was the wrong country to invade and that it had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks and that the Iraq war never should have happened. Do you intentionally keep politics out of the movie?
It was always clearly to get Chris Kyle right and tell a human story. And quite frankly, in the beginning, Terry, you know, 2 years ago, I just liked the idea of a character study based on this conflict that I hadn't seen a war movie or a movie of this genre that focused around a human being. It was always sort of Black Hawk Down was about an incident. Jarhead was about the sort of impotency of that time period. I did not see Hurt Locker, so I can't speak to that. But I thought, you know, Born on the 4th of July was the last time I remember seeing a sort of a biopic that took us through an experience that we've all sort of observed. So for me, that's what I enjoyed about it initially. And I love the idea of framing it as a Western and that this guy happened to be incredibly charismatic.
What do you mean by framing it as a Western?
You have a guy going into a town and there's his equivalent on the other side. Another sharpshooter. He's a sharpshooter. You end it in a you know, tumbleweeds, a dust storm. There's a showdown. You know, this sort of one man and his sort of pursuit, that idea, framing this within a Western construct was sort of something that I thought would be interesting.
I've heard people criticizing you for making a film that's like a Western. That's how far it's gotten. A lot of the criticism that you've been taking has been coming from people who opposed the war in Iraq and think the film should have been making a stronger, this was the wrong war to fight statement. And, you know, a lot of people who oppose the war in Iraq are very, you know, strong in saying, I oppose the war, but I support our troops. I support our men and women who risk their lives. But I'm wondering if you think that there are some people who feel like they oppose the war, they support the troops, but that they draw the line when the troops had to do something like kill someone. You know, like, I support the troops, but this guy here was a sniper. He killed people.
You know, Chris talked about, I remember hearing an interview with him, and he talked about, he was asked that question, a similar question about being over there and the choices and why. And, you know, and he talked about how that's not his job. You know, he made a commitment and an oath to his country. And if you have an issue with it, the people that you really need to talk to are those who make the decisions of where to send the troops. And he would wish that that attention was diverted to them and instead maybe look at what the sacrifice is. That's how we looked at this movie. We looked at this movie as hopefully igniting a conversation about the lack of care and attention that goes towards vets. And, you know, the fact that it's inciting a discussion that has nothing to do with vets and it's more about the Iraq war or why or what we did not do to indict those who decided to go to the war, you know, every conversation that is in those terms, Terry, is moving farther and farther away from what our soldiers go through and the fact that 22 vets commit suicide each day, that, you know, the amount of people that come home is so much greater than before because of medical advancement. And that we need to take care of them.
Can we pause for a second and listen to a minute of Chris Kyle?
Sure.
This is from an interview that he did at the Fellowship Church. It's called Freedom Experience at Fellowship Church from 2012, which is the year of his book tour. He's being interviewed by Ed Young. And in this part, he's describing some of the things he had to learn to be a sniper and to be a long-distance sniper. So here's Chris Kyle talking about the skill that you need and the analysis, the calculations you need to do when you're a sniper.
There's a lot of math involved. I mean, especially when you're shooting past 1,000 yards, you have, you know, the Coriolis effect, which you've got the curvature of the earth. The earth isn't flat. So you have to learn how your bullet's traveling, and they all have a right-hand twist in them. The rifles are all right-hand twisted, so when that bullet comes out, it starts to spin to the right over a period of time, so you have to factor that in. Take into effect all the different winds.
Wow.
And then the rotation of the earth, because nothing you shoot is actually a static target. Everything is moving. So if you're shooting a target that's in the east, you know, is it moving east to west? Is it moving west to east? Or is it, depends on where you are on the map is how the earth is turning.
Tell me about fear. How do you, how did you deal with fear and how do you deal with fear?
It's definitely nerve-wracking. I guess over time, you kind of get hardened to it, and in a way, you accept death. You're there for a reason. You know what the possible outcomes could be, and you're willing to give your life. I mean, every vet who goes overseas, he writes out a blank check to the country and says, this is up to the value of my life.
Mm.
And, you know, fortunately for me, mine didn't, I didn't have to give the full amount.
So that's a 2012 interview with Chris Kyle. My guest is Bradley Cooper, who stars in and produced the new film American Sniper. And it's you know, you knew something playing him and working on this movie that he would never know, which is that he would be killed, but not in war. He'd be killed at home by a fellow vet, one that he was trying to help. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to know that and play him not knowing it.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Terry, hearing that back. I listened to that interview probably 80 times.
Really?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, I lived with him. I had his, I basically made this document where I had every single thing he's ever said recorded, and I would just listen to it and be the first thing I woke up with in the morning. I just put on the earbuds right away, and last thing I listened to at night, and just to really sort of soak him in. And so it got up just something about him that was just beautiful. Yeah, it's just horrible. You know, seeing videos, Terry, home videos, you know, where they have the date on the bottom right corner. And it would be like, you know, November 2012, November 23rd or 24th, Thanksgiving, and then Christmas. And then knowing that a month later on February 2nd, 2013, his life would be ended. I mean, it was just a very emotional thing to be watching. And I almost felt like I was an alien or somebody from the future doing sort of research coming into this man's life and watching every single thing he did at knowing the end of the story. You know, sitting in his dining room table in the same chair he sat in a year prior, you know, with Clint opposite me, with Taya and the children, and having watched a video of him in that chair, it was just a very surreal experience, and one that really prompted me to work in a way that I didn't even know I was able to give that much energy. But when you're doing it for somebody and you realize that the family, the children are going to have this product, this film to represent their father, their husband, their brother for the rest of their lives, it you realize what an honor it is.
Had you gotten to spend time with Chris Kyle before he was killed?
No, Terry. I talked to him one time on the phone, had a cursory conversation early on, trying to sort of soften any fears he had about Hollywood or me. And I just thought, let me just get on the phone with this guy and so he can hear my voice, I can hear his. And I just said, hey, man, I really want to, you know, go on this path with you, and I want to come to Midlothian, and let's really flush out your story and teach me everything you can. And I just want to soak it up, and let's try to tell your story. And I just wanted to let him know who I am and that, you know, I mean what I say. And we had a nice conversation, and I got right away his sense of humor, right away. You could just feel it. And you could hear his voice in that interview. I mean, very open guy, very humble, just sort of not studied in the way that he responds to questions. You know, a real authenticity and just a wonderful Texas lilt. And I just sort of loved the guy right away.
So what was his reaction to you wanting to do the film and to you playing him? Did he give you his blessing?
He did. He did on that phone call with the warning that, you know, that he's going to have to strap me to the back of his truck and get the pretty out of me, which I took as a joke. I thought he was kidding. And, you know, I think he also knew that I had been involved with the Veterans Affairs and been on, you know, I'd been to Iraq and Afghanistan twice at that point. So he was aware of my past.
What were you doing there?
I did a USO tour. I did a couple of USO tours over there in 2011 and I think 2010.
What did you do on the tours?
You know, you just basically, that's such a good question. Everybody would always ask me because, you know,
you're
Bob
not
Hope
singing and you're
it.
Not doing
stand-up. Right.
Yeah.
So what the heck
so
are
what are you
doing?
Shakespeare soliloquies.
It's true. And, you know, I started to do it a long time ago before Hangover, you know, right around Wedding Crashers. And the first place I went to was Guantanamo Bay. So I went there. They sent me there. And often I would be walking into rooms and the superior officer would tell the soldiers, you know, this is Bradley Cooper from Alias. You know, he's here to just say hello. And you could tell that they were like, oh, whatever. And I remember setting up, this is hilarious, at a desk with posters. They make out these little like 5x7 cards with your face on it that you can write autographs, and they had like 200 of them. And it was a really windy day, and I'm sitting there with my buddy just at a little like, I'm going to look like a lemonade stand outside of like the local whatever food restaurant there was for people to come in. And it was very windy, and no one was stopping. And there was such a wind that the cards kept blowing. So all I did was basically try to pick up cards with my picture on it to put back on the desk that nobody's visiting.
That's horrible. So it's like a really bad book tour.
It really was hilarious.
But once you became better known, what did you do?
Did the same thing, but then people started to come by and want the signature. And then you get to – then it actually became incredible. We went to all these FOBs, these forward operating bases. You basically piggyback on missions. So, you know, we landed on the USS Reagan. We took Chinook helicopters all throughout Afghanistan, Blackhawks, visited the Air Force. And then you go and see these guys that have been out there for 6 weeks, haven't seen anybody else. And you spend 2 or 3 hours with them and eat with them and talk to them. And you see on their faces just the relief I felt at seeing a familiar face or somebody that they'd seen in the movies or watching a bootleg copy of The Hangover. That's what many that have seen The Hangover, you know, from a video camera taken in the third row of a movie theater. But it was amazing. It was incredible.
Bradley Cooper speaking with Terry Gross last week. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in American Sniper as Chris Kyle, the Navy SEAL who's considered the best sniper in U.S. military history. After 4 deployments in Iraq, Kyle was killed near his home by a troubled vet he was trying to help. Cooper currently stars in the Broadway revival of The Elephant Man.
Chris Kyle's creed was God, country, family, in that order. And I'm sure there's a lot you related to about Chris Kyle and other things that you didn't. As an actor, you bring yourself to the role. And then you do your best to inhabit the character that you're playing. What did you most directly connect with about Kyle, and what was like so different from you? You had to really use empathy to understand who he was.
This was a very particular circumstance for me, playing a real human being. The only time I'd ever done that before was with Joseph Merrick, but that was for theater, actually, what I'm doing right now.
That's The Elephant Man, yeah.
The Elephant Man, correct. I approached it in a way, Terry, outside in. I knew that there was no way I was even going to get to a place of relating to him, having empathy for, or understanding him at all, unless I got as big as he was and learned to talk.
You mean physically big?
Physically, yeah. And get to a place where I could at least be semi-dexterous with the .338 Lapua, the .300 Win Mag, and the Mark 11, the 3 sniper rifles he used on those tours. I just knew that I didn't have anywhere to begin. I didn't have a foothold on this guy until I did these very sort of practical things, took these practical steps. Because I did recognize that the thing that was interesting to me about him was this massive physical presence with this very gentle inside and humorous demeanor. And that dichotomy is what heightened those aspects of his internal life. So without the aesthetic, I wouldn't be able to see the inner. And I was terrified, Terry, I have to say. The 3.5 months I had to prep, I did go to sleep often thinking, oh, my God, I just don't know. Because if I show up that first day and I don't believe I'm Chris Kyle, I am not going to make the movie. I would just say I didn't get there and I apologize and Warner Brothers would sue me. So that's how I approached it. And because of that – now – granted, as I'm doing the physical work every day and the vocal work, as I was doing that, I was also listening to him and doing all of the research and on weekends training with the rifles. And it just started to happen. And one day I kind of woke up. Now, my mother was living with me at the time. And it's funny, in retrospect, after she saw the movie, she said, oh, now I understand why you were the way you were. Like, I guess I didn't really talk to her very much for those 3 months. But it was one of those things that it just gradually started to happen, and I started to just talk like him all the time. And I remember as I started to walk down the streets and people dealing with me differently because of the size, and all of a sudden, reality changed. And when that occurred, I was able to then go inside of him and start to tell the story that was asked for by the script.
So you physically put on about 40 pounds of muscle
yeah.
to feel like Chris Kyle and to portray him. But if you put on a costume as an actor, you can take it off at night and go home, and then you're yourself again. If you're transforming your body with 40 pounds of muscle and your body is looking and feeling different than it always does as Bradley Cooper, and you're physically capable of things that you weren't physically capable of as Bradley Cooper, what happens when you go home at night and you're trying to be Bradley Cooper? Like, did you feel like a different person in ways that maybe were making you uncomfortable ever?
No, not uncomfortable, but what you're describing is a great example of what I experienced. It wasn't at all like a costume. It was like, and that's why it felt, and I'm trying to find the word for it, this sort of transformative experience to me, because there was no going home from it. It was a gradual change that then became my daily life until I started to shed him after we stopped shooting, which actually didn't happen for 3 or 4 weeks. I remember waking up one morning and knowing that he was gone, and I just knew it, and he was just gone from me.
How did you
know it? I don't know. I just woke up one day, and I could just feel it, that he wasn't there. I know it sounds so crazy. But that's the way it – I mean, I'd be lying if I said that wasn't happening. I remember telling somebody, I said, yeah, he's gone. And I remember somebody looking me in the eyes and go, yeah, I don't see him anymore. You know, yeah, yeah.
So yeah. I just want to acknowledge that as we're talking about that experience of trying to, you know, inhabit the character of Chris Kyle, as you speak about this now, in a few hours, you're going to be on stage on Broadway – yeah. As we record this, playing the Elephant Man, who is, you know, among the most vulnerable people in history, in the sense that he was born, like, severely deformed, and so deformed that he was in a freak show for many years. And
yeah, he wasn't born deformed, but yeah.
He grew deformed. Yeah,
that's right.
So you're going to go on stage tonight and be as vulnerable as you can express. And it's just exactly the opposite of what we've been talking about.
Is it? It feels exactly the same thing.
In what sense?
Well, I'm playing another person who has a physical body that is much different than my own normally.
Sure, okay, sure.
So I go through this physical transformation and vocal transformation. He was someone who grew up in Leicester, who was British and lived in London. It doesn't sound like a guy from Philadelphia. So I have to make those two transformations in order to then let him in. So it's funny, Terry, it's actually exactly the same process.
It's exactly the same process to get to an exactly opposite place. Because instead of being like the sniper who's so well trained and is such a kind of physical specimen, you're playing the person who was in the freak sideshow in a carnival. And let me just read from the script of the play. And this is how Dr. Treves, who rescues him from the freak show and gives him a home and shelter for the first time and treats him like a human being, which is so unusual for him. So this is Treves', you know, medical description. The most striking feature about him was his enormous head. Its circumference was about that of a man's waist. From the brow there projected a huge bony mass like a loaf, while from the back of his head hung a baggy sponge, fungus-looking skin, the surface of which was comparable to brown cauliflower. The osseous growth on the forehead, at this stage about the size of a tangerine, almost occluded one eye. And the description goes on after that. But anyways, that's who you are portraying tonight.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. To me, I see more similarities between Joseph and Chris than differences. And I'll explain what I mean. You know, Chris, if you watch any interview with him, not very animated physically. It's all in his eyes. Doesn't even move his head that much. And he always had a dip in his mouth. So his actually lower lip was always sort of protruded. And when you have a dip in your mouth, you don't tend to, you know, you keep – and also the Texas accent, you know, it's a very sort of closed mouth way of talking. So he had to express a lot of what he was feeling and doing through his eyes and his voice, and very similar to Merrick. So I actually see a lot of similarities in terms of the approach of the way these two men walked through their lives.
Bradley Cooper, it's been so great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you so much.
Bradley Cooper spoke with Terry last week. Cooper stars in the new film American Sniper, which is based on the true story of Navy SEAL Chris Kyle. Sunday and Monday, the AMC cable network is presenting the two-night premiere of Better Call Saul, starring Bob Odenkirk as a fast-talking, struggling lawyer. It's the much-anticipated prequel to Breaking Bad, which I consider the best drama series ever produced for television. Better Call Saul not only stands right alongside Breaking Bad as a stunningly entertaining TV series, it stands on its own. Oh, if you know Breaking Bad well, you'll love some of the surprise treats and appearances heading your way. But even if you're a complete stranger to the character played by Bob Odenkirk in Better Call Saul, you're in for a great ride. Better Call Saul has the same tight plots, rich characters, and delicious twists as its parent series. Yet Better Call Saul isn't a reboot, it's a pre-boot. The central story of this new AMC series tells how Jimmy McGill, a scrappy low-rent public defender in Albuquerque, New Mexico, came to adopt a sleazy new persona as Saul Goodman, a criminal lawyer specializing in representing unabashed criminals. If Saul Goodman were a superhero, this would be his origin story. And that's really what this show is about, because Jimmy McGill, from the start, does have a superpower. It's his quick wit, his fast mouth. Better Call Saul is co-created by Gilligan, who created Breaking Bad, and Peter Gould, the writer-producer who created the Saul Goodman character way back in Season 2. Together, they've come up with something very ambitious and yet very playful here. For starters, literally, this prequel series actually begins as a sequel, set somewhere in the snowy north after the events of Breaking Bad. Saul is hiding in plain sight, just as he said he would, with a new name and a blend into the woodwork job managing a Cinnabon concession at a local mall. Yet he's terrified that even in that public a place, danger and death lurk behind every corner and can be read in every unsmiling face. To me, it's as if Better Call Saul starts precisely where The Sopranos suddenly stopped. There are two stylistic choices in this opening scene that ought to sell viewers on Better Call Saul immediately. One is that this scene, set in the current timeline after the end of Breaking Bad, is in black and white. That's how bleak Saul's new life is. And for this new show's first 7 minutes, Saul doesn't say a word. Not one. This guy who lived and prospered with his gift of gab, like a courtroom Sergeant Bilko, is completely silent for what in TV terms is an eternity. It's only when he goes home, pours a drink, gets bored watching television, and slides an old video cassette into his VCR to watch a series of his vintage TV ads that we hear his voice for the first time. The older Saul listens and watches wistfully as director Gilligan closes in on his weary face.
Don't let false allegations bully you into an unfair fight. Hi, I'm Saul Goodman, and I will do the fighting for you. No charge is too big for me. When legal forces have you cornered, better call Saul.
After that, the series flashes back to 2002, long before those ads were produced, when the future Saul Goodman was still a hustling attorney named Jimmy McGill. Now the show switches to color, a reversal of the usual cinema dynamic of color for the present and black and white for the past, and Better Call Saul really takes off. I'm determined not to spoil any surprises here, but in the first hour alone, there's one that made me smile and another that made me gasp. And it shouldn't be surprising, given how Gilligan cast Malcolm in the Middle sitcom actor Bryan Cranston and allowed him to blossom as the Emmy-winning dramatic actor of Breaking Bad, that comic actor Bob Odenkirk is given such weight and responsibility here. But he is, and Odenkirk is thrilling. Another brilliant genre-crossing role from another gifted actor. Here's Odenkirk as Jimmy McGill, trying to persuade a young accountant and his wife to allow him to represent them. You can hear the pitch, but at the same time, you can almost smell the desperation.
Look, all I know is what I read in the paper. And typically, when money goes missing from the county treasury, and the number here is 1.6 million...
Well, that's an accounting discrepancy.
It's a discrepancy, absolutely. But typically, when that happens, the police look at the treasurer, and since that person is, I just think a little proactivity may be in order.
Yeah, well, I just think I'd look guilty if I hired a lawyer.
No, actually, it's getting arrested that makes people look guilty, even the innocent ones. And innocent people get arrested every day. And they find themselves in a little room with a detective who acts like he's their best friend. Talk to me, he says. Help me clear this thing up. You don't need a lawyer. Only guilty people need lawyers. And boom, hey, that's when it all goes south. That's when you want someone in your corner, someone who will fight tooth and nail. Lawyers, you know, we're like health insurance. You hope you never need it, but man, oh man, not having it? No.
There are plenty of funny moments in Better Call Saul. And, at least in the opening episodes, some very overt stylistic nods to a few classic films from the 70s. But there's drama and darkness, too. Even though we know Jimmy McGill will survive the flashbacks in this series, there's still a lot of tension. And watching him transform is going to be a blast. In the new book, Touch, our next guest, neuroscientist David Linden, explains how pleasure and pain result from the weird, complex, and often counterintuitive system of touch circuits involving the skin, nerves, and brain. Pleasure also figures into Linden's previous book, The Compass of Pleasure, how our brains make fatty foods, orgasm, exercise, marijuana, generosity, vodka, learning, and gambling feel so good. Linden is a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and is a former chief editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
David Linden, welcome back to Fresh Air. So your book kind of starts with this game that people often play, the what-if game. And one of the turns the what-if game plays is, what if you had to lose all your senses except one, which would you keep? And people always want to save their sight or save their hearing. And you think they're not worried enough about saving their sense of touch. What don't we realize about how important touch is?
Well, I think the reason that touch doesn't come up is because we can't easily imagine losing it. We can close our eyes and imagine being blind. We can plug our ears or plug our nose. But there's no way to turn off touch. It's always there. And because it's always on, we take it for granted.
And what's its importance?
Touch is so central to our humanity that it's hard to even imagine it. For example, if a child is born blind, they can grow up and have a completely full and normal life. They will be cognitively normal, psychiatrically normal, and not have profound problems. The same if a child is born deaf. However, if a child is born into a situation like occurred in Romanian orphanages in the 1980s and 90s, where social touch is deprived because there are not enough caregivers around, then that child will develop terrible psychiatric problems, attachment disorders, mood disorders, and also physical problems, problems with the digestive system and the immune system, higher incidences of diabetes. And amazingly, these problems persist throughout life.
And of course, there's the issue if you don't have touch and you don't experience pain, you don't know that you're hurting yourself and you can kill yourself that way accidentally.
Well, so there are a number of different relatively rare cases where you can lose different aspects of touch. And one of them that you're alluding to is called congenital insensitivity to pain. And so folks who have this inherited syndrome, if they whack themselves on the thumb with a hammer, they'll feel the pressure and the thumb will swell up, but they won't feel any pain at all. And there's a famous case of a boy in Pakistan who jumped off of a high roof to impress his friends. He hit the ground, got up, said, "I feel fine," and he went home and he promptly died because he had no pain to realize that he had broken bones and sustained massive internal injuries. So we think, oh, great, a life without pain, that would be idyllic. But if you don't have pain, then you don't have the protective reactions that are so crucial. You will put hot food into your mouth and burn your esophagus. You'll wear clothes that are too tight and cut into your skin and they get infections. It's actually a terrible thing.
Why does it feel so good to be caressed? Why do we get such pleasure of being touched in a loving way?
It turns out remarkably that in our skin, particularly in our hairy skin, that is to say the skin on all parts of our body except a few places like the lips and the palms and the soles and the tips of the fingers, all that hairy skin has a special caress sensor. This is a nerve ending that wraps around hair follicle bases and detects the deflection of hairs. And remarkably, these nerve endings are tuned precisely to the kinds of caresses that we find most appealing. So just imagine that someone is stroking you on the arm. If they stroke really slowly, it doesn't feel loving. It feels like a crawling bug. It's repellent. And if someone strokes very quickly, it doesn't feel loving either. There is a range of speeds in which that caress feels good and prosocial and affiliative. And you might think, oh, well, that's just because the nerves in the skin will detect the whole range of caresses, and it'll send that information to the brain, and then the brain will be programmed to make the decision of what feels good. That's not the case. If you actually record electrical activity from these nerve endings long before they get to the brain, they send more signals to the caresses that feel the best.
Does it feel different to be stroked against the grain of the hair? Like when you pet a cat, you pet it with the grain of the hair. You don't pet it the opposite way.
That's absolutely right. So it does feel different, and it feels different because there are sensors that wrap around the base of the hair follicles that only wrap around one half of the base. If you looked in a microscope, you would see that they don't make a full 360-degree circle. They cover about 180 degrees of the base, and that means that they are tuned to detect deflection in one direction versus the other. When we think about the way we speak in our lives, if we have a bad interaction with someone, we might say, he or she rubs me the wrong way. Someone who is socially clumsy, we call tactless. Literally, they lack touch. It's telling us something that so many of our common expressions in English refer to the tactile sense.
So different parts of the body experience sensation in different ways. Like there are things, the fingertips are equipped to feel that other parts of the body aren't equipped to feel. So give us some examples of what fingers are designed to experience through touch.
So fingertips are endowed with a number of different sensors for mechanical stimuli. So there's one sensor called a Merkel ending that's very good for feeling texture and fine little bumps. There's a different one that is good for vibration. So if you are driving your car and there are subtle vibrations that come from the road through your tires up through the steering through the wheel that you use to detect how slick the road is, for example, or what the texture of it is, if it's pebbly or smooth, that is being detected by what are called Pacinian sensors in your fingertips and in the palms of your hands. The
Can I just stop you there? Even though your fingertips aren't on the ground, they're just on the steering wheel, it's your fingertips that are communicating that information?
They are. Remarkably, these sensors seem to be really good at detecting sensations at the ends of tools. Now, just imagine that you have a shovel in your hand and you're out in your garden and you make a motion to embed the shovel in a pile of sand versus a pile of loose dirt versus a pile of rocky dirt. You can feel the difference in your hands, even though the difference is only at the end of the shovel, which might be 5 feet away. Those sensations are being largely transmitted by your Pacinian sensors. The same thing is happening with a violinist sensing the tension of the strings with the bow, or a sculptor with a chisel, or a surgeon with a scalpel. A car is just another tool, and so it's a tool in part to feel the road through this linkage from the tires up to your fingers.
Let's get to pain. You write that pain isn't a single discrete sensation, even when you experience it in a single moment in time. What do you mean that it's not a single discrete sensation?
Well, if you whack your big toe against the wall, right? You have an immediate sharp pain sensation that you feel nearly instantly. And then you can count 1/1002, or as I like to count, in a Gata De Vita, baby. And then, only then, does the second wave of pain arrive. And this is because there are two separate pain systems in your skin and in your muscles. There is a very fast one that travels at over 100 miles an hour, and then there's this very slow one that moves at sidewalk strolling speed of about 2 miles an hour. And the fast one has a lot of detail. Where exactly is the pain? And this is the one that subserves protective reflexes, jerking your hand away from a hot stove, for example. And then the slow one is the lingering pain that drives decisions like, do I need to attend to this wound? Do I need to adopt a posture or a mode of walking to protect this injured area from further damage? So there's a fast and a slow sensation, but I think just as importantly, perhaps more importantly, there are separate sensory aspects of pain and emotional aspects of pain. There are separate places in the brain, the primary somatosensory cortex for the facts and the posterior insula for the emotional aspect, and these areas are completely different, and as a result, when people sustain damage to one or the other, they can feel pain in a way that is very odd. So, for example, if you sustain damage to your brain's emotional pain center, then you will have a syndrome called pain asymbolia. And so if you whack yourself on the thumb with a hammer, you would go, yeah, that hurts. That hurts quite a bit. It's on my thumb. Now it's throbbing. Boy, does that hurt. But you wouldn't have the typical emotional reaction. Oh, heck. Oh, that hurts. Ow, ow, ow. Oh, that hurts. That's terrible. That's awful. People who have pain asymbolia are not masochists. They don't enjoy pain. For masochists, pain has enormous positive emotional meaning. Pain asymbolics have no emotional component of pain whatsoever. And then there are people who sustain damage to the opposite system, the one for the discriminative facts. And in that case, they hit themselves on the thumb with a hammer, or you hit them on the thumb with a hammer, and they go, oh, oh, that's terrible. And you say, oh, I'm so sorry. Where on your body is the pain? And they say, I have no idea.
Recent research shows that there really is a connection between pleasure and pain in the sense that dopamine, which has always been associated with pleasure, is also released with pain. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, it's really kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? Because you think, well, pleasure and pain are opposites. And we don't entirely understand it. Part of what we know is that when pain ends, that is pleasurable. Thinking of taking off your ski boots after the end of a day of skiing, it feels really good. But there's something more complicated than that. And what I think it is that both pain and pleasure are emotionally salient. They mark experiences that are important for your life. And in terms of memory, they're the signal that says, this is important. Write this down and underline it. Don't forget it. The example that everyone uses is that everyone remembers what innocuous thing they were doing when they got the news about 9/11. That memory that would otherwise be utterly discarded is now seared into one's consciousness forever because of the strong emotional nature of that moment. So both pain and pleasure are share salience. I think this is part of the explanation of why chili peppers are popular in food. They're a bit painful. Why should we want to put something painful in our food? I think it is because it is rewarding to eat something that's a little bit of a threat.
Hmm. Well, it certainly gives more sensation to the food.
Well, it plays with other aspects of sensation. And this is brings up, I think, a really interesting point. Most of us are used to thinking that our food sensations come from a mixture of taste receptors on our tongue and smell receptors in our nose. But it turns out that many of the things that we think of in the experience of eating food actually come from touch receptors. Not only things like mouthfeel, is that apple crunchy and good or is it mealy and soggy, but also the action of things like chili peppers to give a heating sensation and mint to give a cooling sensation. Those are actually all from the activation of touch receptors that happen to be in the oral cavity.
One of your areas of research is memory. And I would love it if you would tell us something exciting in the forefront of science now that relates to our knowledge of memory, how it works, and how it diminishes.
Well, I think, to my mind, the most important realization that's come in recent years about memory is that it is not like a computer's hard drive or a card catalog full of cards with information written on it that you pull out and look at and then put back and then come back to again and again. What we now know is that every act of recollecting a memory makes it a little bit labile so that every time we recall a memory, we can alter it a little bit. We render it susceptible to change. And you might think, well, why would you want to do that? Isn't that just a bug? Doesn't that just degrade the fidelity of memory? But the important thing is that it's actually a feature. Memory is only useful to us if we can link it with all our life experiences and our ongoing experiences that accrue after the memory was initially laid down in the brain. If we can't cross-reference it, then memory isn't very useful. And this process of making it labile during recall is what allows us to cross-reference it with subsequent experience. Now, the dark side of that is that it also means that our memories for facts and events are often not very accurate, and eyewitnesses are not very accurate. And what's worse than that, it's not just that our memories aren't that good, it's that we don't even know when they're not that good. So if you ask people in situations where you can check up on them, how confident are you that your memory is accurate about this event, their indication of their confidence is no prediction at all about how accurate they really are.
So, first of all, I've never heard the word labile before. That means changeable? What does it mean?
Labile means changeable, yes.
So when you say that memories are constantly changing and they need to be constantly reintegrated into who we are and what we're thinking, is one example of that how the memories we made as a child, we keep kind of reinterpreting them as we get older and a little smarter and more knowledgeable?
Not only can we continually reinterpret them, we are subject to bias from people around us. And we are the most subject to this bias when we're small. It turns out if you want to implant a false memory in a 5-year-old, it's an extraordinarily easy thing to do. You say, you remember that time the clown came to your kindergarten last week? No. The next week, you remember the time the clown came to the kindergarten? Yeah, I think I do. The third week, do you remember the time the clown came to your kindergarten? Yes, I do. I remember he had a funny red nose and green hair. So not only can you implant false memories, but you can then cause someone to start elaborating very reasonable sounding details based on those utterly false memories.
Okay, well, this has just been fascinating. I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much. It was lots of fun.
David Linden spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Linden's new book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Reputation.com, working to help individuals and businesses manage how others see them in online search results at 1-800-REPUTATION. And from Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years.